All right, we have Ben Brickwick here. Our worlds got to collide a couple weeks ago in Colorado at the Taylor Welsh event, and we hit it off right away, right? Our ecosystems, we serve a lot of the same types of clients. We got to share a lot of cool stories, and immediately I knew we needed to get Ben on the show to share some of his stories, where he's been, where he's at today, where he's going with himself, his business, and his clients. Ben is the founder and CEO of Sagewood Advisors, founder and CEO of Lodgepole Law. He's an M&A advisor, exit strategist, attorney, if I hadn't already said that, author, speaker, father, husband, investor, etc. Ben, how's it going, brother?
Man, that's good. That's quite quite a long string of things. I'll make it easier next time.
A little bit of a better intro than the first take. First take, I went through this. I couldn't pronounce the law firm properly. Amazon showed up, took you away from the desk. So it was a blessing in disguise.
But we're here. So let's make it happen.
We're here. So Ben, I mean, for our listeners, you know, a lot of our listeners on this podcast are young entrepreneurs, 20s, 30s, 40s, all decades of those ages in our opinion are young, right? So
wait, 40 still gets to be young?
You're still young, bro. You're still young. So most of them are entrepreneurs. They're in that what we would call stage two phase of their business career, where they're not in startup mode. They're not in that necessarily over the mountain yet to go ahead and sell, but they're in this position where they're in growth mode. They're trying to optimize their business. They're trying to figure out, you know, how to get to that season of exit in the future, right? So with all that in mind, I mean, would you mind sharing your story, how you got to where you are today, and then what, you know, you're seeing in the market and what you're doing for your clients in today's day and age?
How much of the story do we want? It all started on a magical evening when my mom and dad met, and we're now we'll skip that one. I've been an entrepreneur business guy since high school. I started my first company while I was still in high school. We were in the snowboard industry. We were making a clothing brand and really schlepping it out of the back of my Subaru so I could afford lift tickets back in the Midwest. I wasn't getting the allowance I needed to afford a lift ticket. So we started making t-shirts, and that ended up progressing into representing some companies. Believe it or not, I've got a photo here somewhere. We won't dig it up for today because it's embarrassing to me, but I used to work. I did a promotional marketing tour for one of the first mountain boarding companies. You guys remember these or know these? You're not old enough. It was like an off-road skateboard, snowboard, had a little love child. And
that's that wild.
Yeah. No.
Here was Ben at 18 and 19 years old, driving a 15 passenger van around the country doing demos. It was nuts, and progressed through there. I tell a story. I don't know if today is the day, but we also had a family business at the time in the training and education space, medical and healthcare world, which actually ended up going belly up. This is, you know, I tell this when I'm on a stage talking about exit strategy, and having motivational alignment is one of the things I think is most important. But you know, we had a scenario where my mother was partnered with somebody else, and they had an offer on the table, and they didn't accept. It wasn't enough. It was this big drama filled mess. And really, that was probably my first taste in selling a company, or more importantly, not selling a company. I went through, ended up staying in the snowboard industry too for a while, lived out in Park City. I didn't have any fun. It was really boring to do more than 100 days on the snow. I mean, you get tired of it, right? It's a joke. You're supposed to laugh.
So how did this all lead you to going to the law school and passing the bar?
Oh, this is fun. So as I progressed out of that industry, I decided probably going back to college would be a good idea. I went back to school, and I was doing marketing consulting at the time, and ended up calling on a business brokerage office. I'd heard about business brokerage. It must be great. I was trying to buy companies or sniffing around. I don't exactly remember, but I got recruited into I was calling on this business brokerage firm. I wanted to sell them marketing services. I'm kind of an old fart here, but these are the days when these guys literally would take out the back page ad of the business section of the newspaper every Sunday to put all their listings in. And there was this newfangled thing called AdWords, Google Ads, pay-per-click. And I went in dead set on telling these guys, like, you got to get out of the newspapers, man. That's no good. They laughed at me. They kicked me out. But somehow they kept my number. A few months later, they called back and said, hey, we've got a role for you. We want you to come in. And it was a three-phase role. They wanted me to be the marketing guy. I was the junior financial analyst, and I helped them build out what's now called a CRM in Salesforce.com. So I had these three hats working in this brokerage shop, and it was a huge shop. This was, we had three locations, probably 30 business brokers in our office, plus two satellite offices, so 50. And I ended up, I was sharing an office with the managing partner. And it's funny, I used to swear that his desk sat at an angle like this. Every time a file would hit his desk, it somehow slid off of there and hit mine. And I'm like, damn. So, I mean, here I am, early mid-20s. I touched probably more than 150 deals just in the first year in terms of looking at the financial analysis, double-checking the people's work on recasting, editing pitch books. And it was strange because at first, you know, you'd get all these brokers that would come in and they'd be asking questions about the deal and I'd listen. And you know, then pretty soon they'd come in and ask questions and I would contribute when the boss was in the room. And before long, even if the boss wasn't there, they'd all come in and just ask me. And so because, you know, the old proverbial drinking from a fire hose, I saw so many deals, so much drama, all the reasons deals die. I saw it firsthand. And I think I saw more deals in my first year there just by being in the right room and having the right role than many business brokers ever see in their career. It was nuts. And I still hate those guys, man. They made me work so hard. In the end, I really do love them, but it was brutal. And so that progressed into, we had a deal and I got a potty mouth. I'll try to be good, but an attorney came in and fucked up a deal for us. And it wasn't so much about us. It was more about the actual buyer and seller in the deal. And this was back, 2007-ish? The economy's not good. We've got a guy who had been working in some Fortune 500 company. He got laid off. He's living off of his 401k, right? Paying those penalties, the things that make guys like you cringe. And he couldn't find a job. So he was going to buy a job. He's buying a business through us. And he found a great business, and he somehow was referred to a $700 an hour, you know, fancy pants, mergers and acquisitions lawyer who knew nothing about the real world of doing a Main Street deal. And this attorney came in, cannonballed the deal, and said, nope, you can't do it. You know, not only wrecked the deal for the seller, but the buyer, everybody was on board. And he wrecks it, but then he had the stones to send an invoice for like 20 grand to this guy. He was already chipping away at his retirement and struggling. And I said, screw it, I can do better. So, you know, I thought long and hard for 24 hours. I applied to take the LSAT. It was in a couple weeks, and there was no online study guides back then. I just went and took it. I somehow got a good enough score to pass. Then was admitted to two different schools. I got to pick one. Lo and behold, put my head down and charged through. And next thing you know, I've got a shiny, shiny new law degree.
There we go. Okay. So let's shift gears to getting tactical, buying and selling businesses, the sexy stuff that everyone talks about. But I want to talk about some of the unsexiness that people don't see behind the scenes. And this is kind of like, for us, it's the fun stuff, but for the outside, like nobody even knows what the mechanisms are going on. Now, high level, just because of the current climate we're in, where have you seen the shift since COVID where business were selling at like ridiculous multiples, and now where we're at this like kind of shift in the market now? What went on there? Walk us through like that crazy season that we went in over the last like 4 or 5 years.
I think it was bananas. And that's my technical legal term, bananas, B-A-N-A-N-A-S. Sure. I think people have been sitting on the sidelines for so long that they wanted something to do. And I think we see these big glorious examples, right? The ones people brag about, but really what people all forget, and even in this crazy season, is, you know, of when people are going to sell their company, if you get five people who want to sell or actively pursuing a sale, only one of those five is actually going to be successful. And we can stat check that. There's resources or sources, I can't remember all where they come from, but I think one of them is a biz buy sell study. And
no, the sources, trust me, bro.
Yeah. My buddy told me. I read it online somewhere. But I think we saw the good ones, but what we forget all the time is all the ones that got shut down because of this chaos and all the ones that died. And I watched my client companies just fall apart. I mean, when we went into COVID, we had several million dollars in the pipeline of clients who are ready to sell, right? And just poof, the rug gets pulled out. And, you know, of course, we don't work for free. We make fees primarily based on success. So it stung us, but it stung more looking at, you know, we had a guy with a diesel repair business who was ready to close and sell and retire. He had plane tickets picked out, man. Like he was ready to take his wife on their first vacation in 15 years or something, and the world shuts down. So I want to make sure we acknowledge all the shittiness that happened too. But I think that's what led into this season of, oh, well, now we're back for certain industries. So we do a lot in the outdoors and the shooting and hunting, and I call it the camouflage side of the outdoors, not the tie-dye, or beef jerky, not granola. But those kind of companies where there was such a shortage in supply chain, and they're selling boxes of ammo that normally retail at $10 and they're selling them for $40, and they're showing this bloated financial statement, and people were actually buying for a while based on that, and kind of ignoring the fundamentals. And now, especially in that industry, we're seeing the hangover of it.
Goes into my next question, which is a super simple one, but I think you'll be able to throw a lot of density into it, is what is a good deal and what is a bad deal?
Oh boy. How much time do we have? Give me a better question than that, man. I'll ramble on for an hour on that.
Here's one. Let's walk through, because I think this is really helpful for people. For those that have aspirations to sell a business or buy a business, but let's go on the sales side. Let's talk 6 to 12 months out, how we start from, you know, prepping for sale all the way towards exit and the high level steps in between. Can you walk us through what a deal looks like?
Yeah, I think the part that always gets missed, it seems, is everybody's so focused on money and how many figures are you doing. And by the way, if you're trying to sell a company, grownups don't refer to 6 or 7 or 8 figures. We don't talk that way. You'll get laughed out of the room with any serious buyers if you use things like, bro, I've got an 8-figure business. Bro, we're scaling on a hockey stick diagram. But before you get into any of that, the part that everybody misses is the motivational alignment of the owner. Like, where do you want to go? And it takes some serious introspection, I think. Now I start to sound all woo-woo, but it's like, are you selling this company because you want to get every last dime out of it? Do you care who you sell it to? Are you going to sell it to the evil competitor? Do you want to make sure that your employees and your customers and everybody's taken care of? So in our approach, we start with that. I got burned on this one time. I sat and I was a new young advisor, right? You know, here's this deal. I might make a commission and it's going to be a big one. We're talking through with this guy of, oh, you can do this to maximize money and we'll sell it to this guy who'll give you the most. And the guy ended up just shaking his head and what's going on? He's like, I don't care about any of that. My wife and I want to go on a mission to Africa to build water wells for people who don't have clean drinking water. So all this stuff you're saying, that's nice, but that's not for me. And then he laughed. It's like, ooh. So starting with that motivational alignment, getting clear on why you want to sell, who you want to sell it to, what do you really need out of it is so important. And I think what people forget is selling a company is not like selling your house, right? You don't put a sign up, you know, have showings for 30 days, go to a closing table and walk away. On some of these more lucrative exits, you have to assume you're going to be around for 3 years. If you want that big multiple, if you want to be able to, you know, get a big dollar amount, that buyer needs you there. And it's so rare. And And in a, you asked about a shorter time horizon. There's usually no way to work yourself out of that business. So we like to explain that getting yourself out of the day to day, right? And it's this cliche, right? It's the e-myth or pick your training, pick your book, have a business that runs without you. It's kind of important here, especially if you want to have an exit where you have a reasonable chance of walking away anytime soon. Mm-hmm.
What is an example of what I would say like a delusional seller, right? I you run into the individual, I think you and I were talking about this a couple weeks ago. They think their business is worth X when it's really worth Y. And they have a little bit of a delusion on what their business should sell for. Just talk through some of the things you're seeing out there right now. And maybe for somebody listening right now that is falling into that delusional category, maybe this is a wake-up call.
Yeah, bring us back to objectivity.
Yeah, we see it in lots of ways, right? And I can go on. Maybe we'll do this later, or we'll do another session to talk about how we get to value and my concept of value mountains. But the delusions are tough. I mean, people, they hear the rumor, right? Or they read online. Or one of my favorite ones is people come in talking about a multiple. We get through talking, and I'm talking about a multiple of earnings, of EBITDA. They think it's a multiple of revenue. Like, guys, just not how it works. And I think the quickest way to get through that delusion is to really sit in the eyes of a buyer. And why does a buyer buy a business? I'm going to ask you guys that. Why does a buyer buy a business?
To make money.
And what are they looking for? What are the things that...
Cash flow. Ease.
Not involvement.
Yeah. So there's a rearward and a forward view here, right? So rearward, they want to know, does this business have a history of making money and how much? What does that path look like? And then forward, they want to know that it's going to continue when they take over, whether that means the owner sticking around, the owner's not sticking around. And the piece I want people to get in their head is that they will pay you for what it's done in the past, but they're buying because of what it can do in the future. Mm. And I've got this right now. I mean, I'm looking out my office window at a strip center for an example, and there's actually one of my clients is over there who's dealing with one of these typical Main Street business brokers who's in here on a small business. And this terrifies me. I'm having trouble even saying it. He's making projections for the next 2 years of where he thinks this business is going so they can justify a higher asking price. Shit. You can't do that for one. There's all sorts of legal issues involved in projections and selling based on it. But the buyer's not buying the business because of all the things that you didn't ever do, but somebody else could.
Hmm.
Right? That's their upside. They're not going to pay you for that. Now they'll buy it because of it. That's a reason why they will pay you a multiple on your past earnings. So they're not going to pay you for earnings 3 years from now.
Sure. So let's talk about the high level steps, you know, steps one through X on how to actually go through a proper clean. I'm sure clean isn't really the word in when it comes to exiting. I'm sure there's all murkiness that comes along with it. But in a perfect world, what does the process of the exit look like from LOI to due diligence to, you know, the seller's agreement, all that type of stuff?
Ooh, we've got a cheat sheet for this, boys. I'm going to pull it right here out of this.
Let's go.
Let's do it.
Let's go.
Oh, man, my cheat sheets are missing. I was ready for that. Let me pull it up somewhere else. I was all excited for this. So we don't have screen share here, do we?
Actually, we do.
Yeah, you can click share.
Let's try it. You can cut this out.
No, let's do it. Good little mark this clip, Tony, so we can throw this on the gram.
Let's do it.
Well, I was excited. Sorry, boys. Wait, I know where it is. I'll get it. Rambling stories, me disappearing. It's like being in school.
It's good. It's good.
So let's do the question again.
walk us through the process of an exit. So from steps one through X, from LOI to due diligence to purchase agreement to, you know, a fruitful back end, what does everything look like high level so that our listeners can know, like, what is the actual process of an exit?
So I, interesting you ask, I've got a handy little cheat sheet here.
There it is. Right on hand.
It was right. How'd here, you get that? Ready That's and crazy. Waiting.
I didn't even see so, it.
So I call it, and this comes out actually of the book, shameless plug of my Peak Exit book. But we have 9 steps, and I don't know, I'm a sucker for threes or triangles when I'm coming up with my models, but 3 phases, right? So number one, you're preparing. Number two, you're matching. And number three, we call the mechanics. It's the boring part, although I kind of like it. So in the preparing part, I talked a little bit about this before, but this motivational alignment and figuring out how your personal goals will tie into the deal. And then we go through this, I call it the Value Mountains framework, where we're figuring out how, and these three are important, so let's pay attention to these. So how valuable your company is, which is the simple stuff of looking at your financial statements, and seeing what I'll call it the book value, right? What do the numbers say? What's the multiple range? Then we get into sellable as the second one. So valuable, sellable. And to me, sellable is just how sexy is this business to a potential buyer? And it doesn't mean it has to be a cool industry or something cutting edge. It just means, are people going to want it? And then we round that out with transferable. So valuable, sellable, transferable. And transferable to me is just, it's the mechanics of, can this business actually be sold? And when you dig into the Value Mountains, I've got cute stories about it. Like I'm in Colorado in the headquarters here at 8,243 feet. We tell all our stories about mountains and trails. But so we go there, and again, motivational alignment. Then we look at these Value Mountains, and then we make a trail map. But the idea is, I want a business owner, before they're starting to talk to any buyers, any advisors, I want them to know what's going on in here and in here, so they can be ready. And so that's this preparation stage. There may be some more parts tied to enhancements in there too, but we want you to be ready. We want your business to be ready. We want you to make the right decision for you, your company, your family. And so those three round out phase one. And then we get into this phase two of matching, and there's 3 more parts here. And first is identifying buyers, right? This isn't generally a game where you can put a for sale sign up in front of your business and say, oh yeah, open house on Tuesday, everybody come in and write an offer. All sorts of problems with that. So in our approach, we go in and we really create, we call it a buyer avatar, right? Who are the people who would be interested in buying? And again, this is all keyed on step one of finding your right alignment here, but maybe you're going to sell it to an employee or your manager or a local financial buyer. And I can go through this list, but there's lots of different steps here. And I think people get accustomed to what they see on the internet or on TV of these huge, giant corporate buyouts. Newsflash, the giant corporate buyout, people don't want your company. And if there's somebody that's listening to this or watching this that proves me wrong, that's fine. There might be one. But in general, it's not going to happen. So we want to look through. We want to plan for this. We're actually working with a few clients now where we're borderline on these. It could be a financial buyer, somebody who's just a regular person that might own another small business, but they want to come in and buy this stream of cash flow to buy a job or buy another little business for their portfolio. But they're also reaching up into a world where there might be strategic buyers, other people that run a similar company that for various reasons want to come in and take over. So we want to make sure as you're getting started, you're at least chasing the right people and looking in the right place or tying the right fly on the end of your fly line for the conditions to catch the right fish. I'll tell you shameless Colorado stories here every chance I get, guys. So after you figure out the type of buyer and the ones to go after, you've got to find your fit is what we call it. You need to talk to a few. You need to kiss a few frogs, I guess, is how we'll say it. The takeaway there is you never just want to talk to one. You want to have multiple conversations. There's people that are going to have all sorts of different views here. And if you're only talking to one potential buyer, you're asking for trouble. And to round out that next one, or the next step here, is structuring a deal. So as you're working through, you're finding the right buyers to target, you're meeting with buyers, and then before they get carried away with any of the mechanics, we want a letter of intent. You want to structure a letter of intent that does a couple of things. I don't know why it's always three, guys. Your letter of intent should be three things. It should outline the price, right? What is going to be paid, the terms, how is it going to be paid, and the timeline of the deal. And if you can, nothing else, if you can get those three into a letter of intent to link up with the right buyer, you're headed the right direction. So that's phase two of matching. I'll keep going. You guys keep smiling and writing things down. I like it. So phase three is mechanics. There's three steps here too. So we call it the verify and defend. That's what everybody calls due diligence, right? So in due diligence as a seller, you want to be verifying and defending all of the assumptions that went into this letter of intent, and that financial, operational, we've got a whole laundry list of them. Step eight, we would then jump into definitive deal documents, right? So these deals live and die in these definitive documents. So up until now, everybody's happy. We verified some things in due diligence. And now we've got to write it all up. And this is the time when lawyers jump in, the time when lawyers come in and kill it. And so the idea here is you don't get into the deal documents too soon. And as a lawyer, people catch me saying this, they'll take my bar card away, but you don't need the lawyer's active involvement until here. I think the more you can give lawyers directions on your deal terms and what you really want to do, the better off you're going to be. And I get it. I can say it because I am one. We're taught very early on to be zealous advocates for our clients. And sometimes we have trouble knowing where the line is between what our client wants to accomplish and how smart we can prove that we are and how much chaos we can add. And then back to my list, step nine, you transact and you formalize the deal, you transfer funds, and you do all the things that hand ownership from one to the other.
I was going to say, selfishly, given that where we come in a lot of the times is in collaboration with the lawyer and the team, talking about the tax impact on the back end, whether it's the buyer or seller, structuring whether it should be an asset sale or a stock sale, what should go towards goodwill or assets and things like that. How active are you in there, and what plays into the decision making into how the deal is structured in that way?
I think it's absolutely part of the conversation at the very beginning in the motivational alignment. So one of the biggest turning points I find with clients when we're exploring their motivational alignment is it's a pretty simple question, and it's, do you need the proceeds of this sale in order to do what's next in your life? Most often that's retirement. And you'd be surprised at how many people that run great businesses that generate millions of dollars in cash flow every year, how many of the owners of these businesses don't have anything set aside. And so their answer to that question is then, holy shit, I need every dime I can get, because if I don't get it, we're done. So we want to have that conversation early. And I see it as we're the guide or the Sherpa at that part of the journey. I'm not a tax expert. That's where I lean on guys like you to really come in, and we say, well, here's where we think this could be. Here's kind of the ecosystem or the range of values we're working with, and let you guys help figure that out. Because if we know that up front, when we get into this part of the avatar of buyers and figuring out who's the right buyer, what's the right structure, then we're able to really find that find that deal that works.
So you mentioned the definitive document stage. Like, that's where we've kind of gotten through all the due diligence up until this point. Now it's a matter of like, hey, how do we structure this agreement of this transaction? And you mentioned that's where things can certainly go south. What are some of the top deal killers you'll see that take place on the seller side and on the buyer side? What are some things to look out for?
I think overall the biggest part is what I'll call memorializing the deal and putting the terms into writing. It's easy to shake hands and, you know, sit in a conference room talking about how this is going to work. But then the actual legal parts are what can get in the way. And it's things that you don't always think of. It's trading and transition. It's non-compete agreements. It's post-closing obligations. I can think of, we had a physician client who had built himself a lifestyle business, right? And he gets to live up in the mountains. He sees patients Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Mondays and Fridays. He kind of screws off. Maybe he's got skiing or fishing. And we get to the table and it had not been discussed. And it's funny how clear these things are in the rearview mirror, right? Like, oh yeah, we should have seen this, but we didn't. The buyer, a bigger medical system, we'll call it a hospital system, is in here and they're working through this employment agreement. And it dawns on this physician that he's got to work 5 days a week now, not three, in order to get the price he wants and for this to continue and hand off, transfer to the new buyer. He's got to work 40 hours a week again. He's like, shit, I can't do this. So little things like that. And you can see it's tough to even make this linear because they all kind of tie together. But I think the biggest takeaway here is communication and understanding, like knowing what these things are that are going to come up. I feel so bad for these clients that, you know, they get a cold, they're ready to sell. They get a cold call from some business broker who says, oh, I've got buyers for a business just like yours. And if you sign this contract with me, we'll go out there and we'll sell it. They don't take the time to do step one. Mm-hmm. And all they want to do is cram some numbers on a paper and go see if they can talk someone into buying this company. And I think that's a big reason why you get this 4 out of 5 that are for sale, but don't end up selling.
So well said. And we've seen it on our level at our impact. We've taken on clients that they're in year one of a 3-year earnout that didn't even know they had, and they want to go into the next venture, but the non-compete doesn't allow them to get into. And there's all these nuances, and they might as well have just stayed in the business. The business was providing more cash flow than they probably haven't recreated yet. They're sitting on this lump sum and they've never felt more poor because now there's just no more cash flow coming in. So it's really nuanced. And I think that's why it's so important to have someone like Ben at your disposal, someone that actually cares about the person first, because as unemotional as we want to make business, like this is your life. Most of these small business owners, like, this is your life. We're not talking about $100-200 million deals in cash where, you know, it's the, you know, couple million dollars that, you know, is going to last you for the rest of your life that you need to go recreate. So with that, Ben, like, who needs to contact you in terms of ideal client avatar? What type of, business revenue size? I know you were talking about, like, what size business, pain points are they experiencing? Like, who's the ideal person that you would want to contact you if they're listening to this podcast right now?
Well, at a high level, it's pretty easy. We have a no assholes rule here. So if you're a jerk, schmuck.
Love that.
And it's kind of a joke, but not really. I mean, if you're trying to cut corners, if you're out here willing to take the shortcuts because you want a quick hit, you want a quick payday, it's just not for us. I'm getting older and crankier, man. I don't want to deal with that. I want people who will let us do our job. And our job, as I see it, is to be, it's like a fishing outfitter or a Sherpa or a guide. This is our client's journey, not ours. We're not here to prove how smart we are. We're here to point out bear traps that are hidden in the wrong trail. So we generally are working with revenue ranges. I would say $1 to $50 million is, I mean, it's a big range, but it works. you know, and the reality, whether it's us or somebody else, be careful getting into a situation where you're only paying somebody for a certain result. We had a call like that this morning with a client who was just adamant that he's not paying us anything until closing. And I'm like, well, play that out. How's that going to work? Right. We're here. We've explained how everything is different. We get involved early. We want, you know, I talked earlier about motivational alignment on behalf of the client. We want it with us too. We want to be in a place where we are incented and equipped to give clients good information so they can make the right decision. We're not deciding things for them. We're leading them along the way. And if the only way your advisor gets paid is if the company sells, what happens when you get to the, you guys mentioned it before, the definitive document stage, and your buyer's trying to pull a fast one, and the guy who's supposed to be in your corner is whispering in your ear, like, well, that's not that bad.
Mm.
You're like, dude, it's a 25-year non-compete, and I've got to give up my firstborn child. Yeah, you know, it's not that bad. Like,
you always got another kid. Yeah.
Yeah, like, it could be worse. You could have to give up both kids. Like, you should really close this so I can get my commission. So I decided we're just not doing it that way anymore. So we charge money up front. We charge money per month, and we deliver results that you don't get from that commission only. But then also on the other side, I see it from the world of so many entitled lawyers are so used to collecting a giant retainer, billing whatever hours they want to, stopping progress because the retainer ran out. And so we didn't like it that way either. So we came up with a hybrid model, which kind of turned into a shameless plug of how we work, but it is what it is. Yeah, what else? Client, we work with all sorts of industries.
I was going to say, oh, good.
Yeah, just say we have this view here that, you know, we want to work with people who build businesses that, you know, move the economy forward, that make this country great. We don't really relate to the VC backed startup crowd. We're much more, you know, I mentioned before, outdoors. We work with the trades, manufacturing, those that kind of keep the economy doing or moving by doing things. That's the right fit for us.
Totally. And I was going to say too, one thing we tell all our clients, and you've heard me say this before, Ben, is like, a lot of business owners, especially the ones listening to this podcast, they might not be in a position to sell today or even next year or 6 months from now or whatever, but good exit planning is good business strategy. If you're building your business to be attractive from a buyer perspective, that means that you're, you know, relatively creating some level of obsolescence around who, you know, you involved in the business, and you're creating systems and processes to drive revenue long term, right? So that's something we always talk to our clients about. And the other thing, as far as your services go, is I know that you guys have a foundational function or foundational formation service as well. So for clients that are looking to, you know, restructure how they own everything and build out their organizational structure to create more cohesion, that's something that you guys do for business owners as well, which is a great entry point to build a relationship for when that time does come to sell. You know how they own everything and where they own it to make sure that everything is done in such a way on the back end of a sale to where it's going to flow properly and ultimately be as attractive as possible.
Yeah. And to be honest, I don't even like doing it, but we had to. I can't tell you, and we didn't get into this, but when we start at Sagewood on the M&A side, we do this exercise of a mock due diligence, right? So you come in and we give you 48 hours notice, and we give you a list of things that a potential buyer is going to demand a deal. That's another topic for another day, but we started seeing that people don't have operating agreements. They don't have their governance documents. They don't, everything's a mess. So I actually went, and when I created Lodgepole Law, that's one of the cornerstones. You're right. We call it foundational formation, which is the bottom of what we call the business legal fortress. So we want to, no matter what size your business is, we want to get you out of that operating agreement you downloaded, or the, you know, the employment agreement that you snatched from your buddy who runs a similar company. And it's not just small startups that do this. You would be amazed if you knew some of the sizes of companies that have garbage documents that they stole from the internet.
Oh, we had a client at $25 million a year, and they don't even have an operating agreement. Didn't even know what an operating agreement was. 200 properties all in their personal name. Like the biggest misconception is that the more money people make, the more they understand around it, which is the more money you make, the more you need to understand that you don't know everything and why you need to outsource to professionals that literally all they do is nerd out about this stuff. So with that, if you are contemplating even exploring a sale in your business and want to learn about that, how can we connect with you, Ben?
Oh man, there's all sorts of ways. So the M&A firm is Sagewood Advisors. We're at gosagewood.com. Lodgepole Law is pretty easy. It's lodgepolelaw.com. And then actually the newest book that I put out is Peak Exit. Shameless plug there again. Peakexit.com. You can go grab a copy there and really start to get your own. The subtitle of the book is A Business Owner's Field Guide to Selling Your Business on Your Terms. And it's a short, quick read. I know I've shared it with you guys. If nothing else, there's no hook. There's no sales pitch in there. I just want people to understand how this process works and
I love
start
it.
Thinking about it. And you mentioned before about generational issues or the kinds of clients you work with. I'm excited to see that the owners in their 30s and 40s are starting to, it's almost like they begin with the exit in mind, because the older owners, sometimes it's tough. They see an exit as a failure, as it's like death. And man, it's not good.
I love it, man. Well, I think we definitely need to set up a part two to go more in the weeds for sure. Everyone buy Peak Exit, hit up Ben on his websites. Super blessed to just have the opportunity to do life with you, brother. We're in an awesome mastermind together that allows us to stay connected pretty consistently. And I have to imagine that there's going to be a really good path that we cross on the business side as well. So appreciate you taking the time, man.
Yeah, likewise, guys. Humbled to be here. Let me know what else I can do.